Hello and welcome to the podcast of Vineyard Church here in Maryville, Tennessee. We post our Sunday messages here each week, as well as our conversations episodes, which include interviews, special announcements, and in-depth teaching. You can visit vineyardchurch.us to learn more about us or to access the audio archive. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. And now, here's the episode.
All right, good morning. This is the last week I get cool walk-up music. Welcome to the Vineyard. Happy Father's Day. I'm really glad you guys are here. My name's Aaron. A few weeks ago on Mother's Day, we said, hey, why don't you guys set aside the equivalent of one day's wages, and we'll give that money to Convoy of Hope, which is this beautiful, just really well-positioned, hyper-efficient ministry that's in place to serve people in desperate need. We said, we'll give you a few weeks, and then we'll announce how much you gave on Father's Day. Today is Father's Day. You guys gave, drum roll, $31,148.20. That's incredible. You guys are like, hey, why don't you just give thousands of dollars? Like, all right, so you did. That's amazing. That's a lot of money that can help a lot of people. We should really be celebrating that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. If your heart's broken right now because you thought, I wanted to give the money to help feed the kids, but I forgot or I wasn't here or whatever reason, too bad. I'm just kidding. We will always take your money here at the Vineyard. Don't you worry for one second. You can grab one of these. It might be in a chair back in front of you. If not, there's offering cards in the back as well. If you write, make sure you write, I forget what the keyword was, convoy. If you write convoy somewhere on there, we will know that that's designated toward that. So if you want to give, we will be more than happy to update with a bigger number next week. That'll just be more fun for all of us. But so the window hasn't closed, but man, you guys, thank you so much. It's so beautiful. So good. And then let me just recap one quick thing from last week. We're putting together a little bit of a Vineyard Geek Squad. So if you're kind of IT savvy, will you also fill out a card, put your name on it, write the word geek. And then we're putting together a team to help people because we've got all these pastors on Sunday running around trying to fix IT stuff, and it's pathetic, honestly. That's the reality. So we need your help. So if you have some skills in that area, let us know. Drop that off in one of the offering boxes, and we'll be able to get that team up and mobilized soon. Let me invite you to stand as you're able. I'm going to read our text for today, Luke chapter 15. This is week 3 now. We've been looking at the story of the prodigal son. Let me again say happy Father's Day. We honor you, fathers. It's like Mother's Day, but less exciting, but still really good. Still really good. I don't know why it just is, right? Everybody's like, yeah, it checks out. Okay. Luke chapter 15, beginning with verse 11. This is Jesus telling a parable. To illustrate the point further, Jesus told them this story. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, I want my share of your estate now, before you die. So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. A few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land, and there he wasted all his money in wild living. About the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. The young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. When he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, at home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare, and here I'm dying of hunger. I'll go home to my father and say, Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant. So he returned home to his father, and while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. His son said to him, Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son. But his father said to the servants, quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet and kill the calf we've been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for the son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now he's found. So the party began. Verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the fields working. When he returned home, he heard music and dancing in the house, and he asked one of the servants what was going on. Your brother's back, he was told, and your father has killed the fattened calf. We are celebrating because of his safe return. The older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. His father came out and begged him, but he replied, all these years I've slaved for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me to do. And in all that time, you never gave me even one young goat for a feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back, after squandering your money on prostitutes, you celebrate by killing the fattened calf. His father said to him, look, dear son, you've always stayed by me, and everything I have is yours. We had to celebrate this happy day, for your brother was dead and has come back to life. He is lost, but now is found. Would you join me in saying our prayer aloud together? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you alone are King. Give us wisdom, courage, and kindness that we might bear your image well. Unify us in heart, soul, and purpose that the world might know your love. Make us your hands, generous and compassionate. Make us your feet, valiant and steady. In service to you and all you've created, give us love greater than fear. Onward for your kingdom, we're declaring your worth, finding our worth in you, and joining you in the renewal of all things. Amen. You guys can have a seat. Thanks for joining me in that. I'm going to ask you guys here to be a tiny bit nerdy for just a little bit, but hang in with me for a couple of minutes. And what we're going to see is that the ancient Near Eastern culture into which this story was told, it really kind of cranks up the intensity of this parable. It's like there's kind of more going on than initially meets the eye. As we said, saw a couple of weeks ago, Jesus's audience, as he's telling this story, has a combination of Pharisees and other religious leaders, so all the good kids, and a group of what are called in the text notorious sinners, which is quite a designation. Notorious, so all the bad kids. That's the crowd. I cannot think of a modern day equivalent for these Pharisees and religious leaders. So a bit about them. They were incredibly educated in Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible. And so they would have, all of them, actually get this, they would have memorized in full Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, chapter and verse. They could just fire away, memorize them. Guys, they memorized the first five books of the Bible. And let's just be honest, everybody, look at me. Most of you, when you start a Bible reading plan, have a hard time getting past Leviticus. And these monsters had it memorized. They memorized the Torah. And the Torah, of course, is filled with laws. And so they were like legal experts because the legal framework for their day and their context was built out in Torah. So they're religious leaders, but they're also sort of legal leaders. And they were also social leaders because they kind of were seen as holding the keys to, you know, the nation's values and defined what was right and wrong. That was sort of in there. And so they were also political leaders because the Torah gave their political environment as well. So they were political leaders. They made judgments. They were social commentators. They were rich. They were beloved. They were kind of hated. They're just all of it swirled into one. They're like Joel Osteen and N.T. Wright and Bill Haslam and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Kanye and Judge Judy all rolled into one. And that's still not it. Like, that's not even close. I can't think of it's just a unique thing. So that's one part of the group. And then there's this other contingent, the notorious sinners. And they were the social and religious outcasts of society. So these would be prostitutes. These would be people whose jobs required them to publicly sin. So they would be known as sinners. These would be known criminals. These would be people with physical or mental disabilities. And it's like, well, why would that be in the list? One of these things is not like the other. And the unfortunate reality of that moment was that at the time and in that context, people often assumed that if someone had a physical or mental disability of really any kind, that that was probably a curse from God because they were just that sinful or their parents were just that sinful or whatever the case may be. And so that's icky. That was a reality. And then the text specifically names that there were tax collectors there. And again, I cannot think of a modern equivalent for that either. So try to just stick with me here. The Jews lived under the oppressive thumb of the Romans. The Romans were this massive empire that were sustained by just crushing taxes. Tax collectors were fellow Jews who not only did they collect the money that was used to oppress their own people, they lobbied and paid for the right to be tax collectors because that meant that they could charge excessive taxes and make themselves rich in the process. People did not like them at all. They were like the baddest of the bad guys. And all of these people were considered unclean, which is, there's a lot to that, but it was basically the ancient Near Eastern equivalent of cooties. Like if you touch them, then they're evil and their bad mojo or bad whatever will get on you. Okay, and that was there, literally, don't touch them. So in other words, they were the dregs of society and they were contagious. All right. So that's who's listening. Now onto the parable. Jesus said that the younger son asked for his inheritance before his father had died. A few thoughts here. The law of primogeniture, we talked about that last week, and it would be applied differently by, you know, in different contexts and different families. But typically, if there were two sons, as is the case with this one, then the younger son would get a third of the estate and the older son would get two-thirds, a double portion it would sometimes be called. But that was not supposed to happen until the death of the patriarch, until the death of the father. So in saying this, what the younger son is saying to his dad, when he says, I'd like to have my inheritance now, and it may be earmuffs for this part because it's Father's Day, but he said, Dad, I wish you were dead. You're not. If you were dead, I could have your stuff now, but you're not dead yet. So let's pretend you're dead and you give me your stuff now because I want your stuff. Now, this is an intensely patriarchal society. In this context, just expressions of honor and deference and respect, especially for parents, was the absolute highest social expectation. And a traditional Near Eastern father in this situation, like this is, would be expected to respond, and this is what Jesus' audience would expect Jesus to say next, that you would respond with violence and then disownment. That's what you do in a situation like that. The expectation would be that you beat some respect into that kid and then you disown him. You're done. He doesn't get a dime and he's an outcast forever. That would have been the expectation. So it's just shocking to the audience when Jesus says that the father granted the request. He said, okay. The wealth in the family, think about this, the wealth in the family would have primarily been real estate that would have been handed down from generation to generation. And that real estate represented their standing in the community. So in order for the father to grant the son his request, he would have to liquidate much of their land and their property to do that, forever damaging the family's capacity to feed and support themselves. And this would also be seen as just this massive humiliation to the father because it was the patriarch's job to keep the family and to keep their estate together at all costs, no matter what. And then, of course, this falls apart. The kid takes the money. He wastes it on frivolous and selfish rebellion. He hits rock bottom, as we saw, and then he comes home. And when he comes home, you know, famously, the father runs out to meet the son in that moment. And the audience, again, would be expecting the father, if you're going to run out to meet your son under these circumstances, again, you run out to beat that kid mercilessly for having the nerve to show his face at their home again. That's what would be expected. And of course, that's not what happened, as you know. Instead, total shocking move here. He welcomes his son with forgiveness that he didn't even have time to ask him for. He just grants it to him in affection. He wouldn't even listen to the kid's plan to make restitution, just cuts him off. He's like, my son is home. He's just too busy rejoicing that the family's back together. And then he does all these gestures. They're extravagant gestures. We've got the business with him being given the younger son, the rebellious one who's returned home, being given the finest robe in the home, which would have been the father's robe, the ring on his finger, the shoes on his feet. All of this, I want to make sure you understand, this is not just nice gestures or sort of this emotional bubbling up. This is demonstrating publicly that the younger son, who has not paid back a dime, is being fully restored to the family. Which means, as we said last week, it means that once again, he's entitled to an inheritance. Once again, he's entitled to 1/3 of the now smaller family estate, which also means, by the way, should the mood hit, he could do it all again. Take his inheritance and run off and squander it again. And yet it was all restored to him just as it was before. And then the father throws this massive, just community-wide celebration. This huge party. And what's going on here is really important. The father, in throwing this party, is announcing to the whole town, like, hey, guys, I want everybody to know it. My boy is home. He has been fully restored. He has all of the honor and the respects and the rights that he ever had. He's not an outcast. He's an heir, and he's home. And you can imagine that this would be really shocking news to the Pharisees who are listening to this, but also really wonderful news to the others in Jesus' audience, the notorious sinners. It's great news. So this parable is traditionally called the prodigal son, the parable of the prodigal son. We don't use the word prodigal very often anymore, except the only time I ever hear it is really in reference to this parable. Let's look at what the word prodigal means. Like, I just looked it up, Modern Dictionary. Number one, two meanings here. Number one, spending money or resources freely or recklessly, wastefully extravagant. That's definitely what the younger son did. Then we have definition number two, having or giving something on a lavish scale. And then where I looked up, there were two synonyms for this, wasteful and generous. Interesting sort of lexical range to that word, isn't it? So what Pastor Timothy Keller pointed out, and he's right, he's spot on when he says it. This is the story of the prodigal son. He was wasteful and he was reckless. But even more so, this is a story about a prodigal father who was extravagantly and lavishly and ridiculously generous. So just when it seems like the story is going to come to a nice close, as we've seen each week here, the elder brother, the good kid, he finds out what's happening, and then he has his own sort of ugly outburst because he has this sort of sense of entitlement. This entitlement that he had managed to keep inside until then, and then in this moment it kind of comes into full view, and now it becomes the older son's turn to defy and to disgrace the father because he's furious and he stays outside to protest, and that in and of itself would carry lots of sort of cultural weight and meaning. The father finds out about this and he goes and he pleads with his son to come and join the feast. And then the older son in this moment, he reveals his heart. He lists all the good works that he has done and how obedient he has always been. And that means that he deserves more than what he has gotten up to that point. And what happens is then, just like his younger brother, he makes it clear that he doesn't love the father. He just wants his stuff. It's the same situation. Those years of faithfulness and obedience, He wasn't honoring his father in that process. He was building his case. And the father tells him, he says, look around, son. Everything I have is yours. It always has been. Like, who cares about a fattened calf? Everything I have has always been yours. He essentially says, you know, I just got my other son back. I can't lose you now on the same day. And then it just ends. Just poof, the story just ends, and we're left to wonder how the elder son was going to respond to this. And that, of course, is by design, because again, going back to Jesus' audience, he told the story to correct the Pharisees and the religious leaders in his audience. He tells this story to correct the guys in the room who have memorized the first five books of the Bible, and they were really good rule keepers. Because it turns out they were just like the older brother in the story, as it turns out, they found all of this free grace to sinful people, all this kindness to the notorious types. They found it to be off-putting and, of course, terribly unfair that you would be that gracious. And the thing is, they still had no idea. They had no idea how generous, how gracious, how selfless, how prodigal their Heavenly Father really is. This was before even the cross, but the cross was coming. And Jesus was about to demonstrate just how far he was willing to go to bring a prodigal home. And what's hard to accept is that the Father's inheritance, and I've been talking about them now, I'm talking to you now. What's hard to accept is this idea that the Father's inheritance is always given. And it's never earned. It's always and only a gift. Like no currency of behavior or religious duties or good deeds, none of that counts at all. This is about being God's child, period. To us, the Father says, everything I have is yours. And I wonder if you can accept that. That as a child of God, it's just yours. And it's just free gift, period. And you might hear that and go, well, yeah, yes, I can accept a free gift, obviously. What's hard about that? Actually, it's really hard. It's really hard. It takes a tremendous amount of faith for you to put your currency away, your fragile identity of being good enough, to put all that away and just trust that it's always only ever been a free gift, period. When I was a kid, and I meant to bring something up here. David, my backpack, I think, is back there. Will you bring that out here? This is not planned. They're like, oh, they planned it. No, I forgot to bring the thing I was going to show you. We'll see if he finds it. How's it going? Hey! So weird, y'all. It's like a costume change. Like, nope. No, those are different people. Anyway, so when I was a kid, maybe 9 or 10 years old, my dad sat me down at our dining room table, and he pulled out a very old, well-worn book. This is it. It's so falling apart. To be clear, it was old then. This is not, I'm not like this old. This is, I don't know how well you can see it. It was really old then. Okay. And now it's even older now. And he sent me down at the table and he pulled out this book of poetry. and a flip to his favorite poem, and it's now my favorite poem too. It's called The Death of a Hired Man by Robert Frost. If you never read any Robert Frost, man, brilliant. And so he starts to read me this poem, and he had read it to me before. And just like I did before, I found it to be long and boring, and I didn't get it. And just as an aside, by the way, dads, do things that are meaningful even if they're boring. I think we're scared to death to bore our kids. Just be boring and meaningful if that's what it takes. We don't have to constantly entertain them. They've got phones for that. Do something meaningful and boring. If it has to be boring, so be it. Maybe they'll remember it. Maybe they'll just remember the boredom, but maybe they'll remember it and it's something meaningful. Anyway, I was bored and not getting it. And then he looked at me with this sort of newfound intensity. And it signaled to me that this was more than just some other moment. And he explained to me something about that poem, which is the true genius of the poem. And what it's famous for is the two definitions for home. And the sort of mom character in the story, she gives two definitions. The first one, she says, home is the place where when you go there, they have to take you in, which is a pretty good definition. When you go there, they have to take you in. And then she corrects it, and then she upgrades it. She said, what I should have said is, home is something that you somehow haven't to deserve. Home is something, I think we might be able to put that on, I think we have that to put in front of you. I want us to reflect on that thought. Home is something that somehow, oh, we don't have it? My bad. Home is something that we somehow don't have to deserve. You don't earn home. It's just given. So Dad explains that to me, and then he cranks it up even more as this sort of white hot intensity. And he looks at me and he said, son, everything I have is yours. He said, it always has been, and it always will be. And it's not because you're a good kid, even though you're a good kid. It's because you're my son. And it's your birthright. It's your namesake. It's not because you follow the rules, although generally speaking, you follow the rules. He said, no, it's because you're a McCarter. It's because you're mine. And nothing will ever change that. And this is what Jesus was hoping the religious leaders in his audience would hear. He's trying to shake them out of the lies that they have always believed. And what I want you to see, this is not like Jesus stepping in as a coach and saying, oh, hold on a second, guys, you're doing it wrong. Let me show you a better strategy. Let me give you a different technique. Let me show you a better way to play the game. No, he's blowing the whole thing up and saying, guys, you're playing the wrong game. Like, this is the wrong sport. It's entirely wrong. This is exactly 0% about earning favor. And exactly 100% about accepting grace. Period. That's the whole game. And you have to see it. Your failures don't change your inheritance. And neither do your successes. Your sins don't change your status. Your brokenness doesn't change your birthright. It's all a gift. It's all a gift. And there's no way to ever pay for a gift. It's just free grace. Undeserved. Now look, I've been in church my whole life. And I know the pushback that comes when people talk like this. People say, look, man, if you tell people that it's all grace and you tell them it's 0% earning, then you know what'll happen? People will abuse that grace and they'll break all the rules and their lives will fall apart. So don't do that. And I hear that, guys. I do. I hear it. I understand the sentiment. I wrestle with it sometimes as a preacher. I get it. The logic tracks. I get it. But I'm telling you right now, it's dead wrong. It is 100% wrong, and I'll tell you why. My dad made it abundantly clear to me that no amount of rule breaking or rebellion would change my standing in our home, that it was all mine, that he would love me no matter what, that my inheritance was secure no matter what, because it was my birthright, because it was my namesake. And hear me when I tell you this, nothing has ever made me want to obey him more than that. No threat of punishment has ever motivated me to honor him as much as the promise of his grace. And nothing has ever done more to show me that his rules, whether I understood the rules or not, whether I liked the rules or not, nothing has ever done more to demonstrate to me that those rules could be trusted as being for my good. Because he had made it abundantly clear he wasn't trying to get me to earn anything. He didn't need anything from me. He just was determined to see me thrive. That's what made me want to honor my dad. And of course, I didn't always. I was still plenty of stupid, plenty of times, and I broke the rules and I did rebellious things. But again, hear me. Every time that I did pause and think better and make a better choice and be wise instead of impulsive, I can tell you for certain it was not because I was afraid of punishment. It was because I wanted to live in a way that honored the gift that I had been given in accordance with my namesake and my birthright. I hope that tracks. Let me invite you to stand as you're able. The band's going to come. We're going to continue in worship. Let me explain something to you one more time as clearly as I can. The gospel is not be good and you get in. It's not. It is and it has always been just come home. Just come home. Home is something that you somehow haven't to deserve. You don't earn home, you receive home. You just come home. And yes, of course, we live in submission to God and we give our allegiance to him as our king. Of course we do. But hear me, the why, it matters so much, the why. It's not because we're trying to be accepted. If we're being good because we're trying to be accepted, that's all vanity. It's all a lack of faith. None of it's worship. We don't follow the rules because we're trying to be accepted. We follow the rules because we're grateful that we've already been accepted. We don't do as we're told because we're afraid. We do it because we're grateful. And we trust the one who gave us the rules in the first place. You're like, I don't know why that's a rule, but okay. You've demonstrated. So look, guys, again, 0% earning. 100% grace. A lot of people have that flipped. A lot of people have that like 90-10. You know, it's 90% grace and 10%. Let me just tell you, the difference between 99% and 1% versus 100 and 0 is massive. You just accept it and you receive once and for all. You don't earn home. You just go home. So if you're trying to be good enough before you can earn your way in the door, you got to let that go entirely. Just come home. If you think you earn your keep and get to stay home by being good enough, let all of that go. Those efforts to be good enough are vanity anyway. They're a waste. Just be grateful that it's all a gift. And out of that, You'll make a lot more progress living for Jesus, I promise. Let's take a moment to pray. King Jesus, we welcome you to draw very near. We ask that you would make us aware of your presence in this place, your kindness to us. And Lord, would you turn the dials for us and how perhaps we envision our standing before you if we think it's 50% earning and 50% grace, if we think it's 95% grace and 5%. Lord, would you just keep turning the dial and just keep turning the dial and keep turning the dial until it finally clicks for us. It's all grace. It's all grace. It's all grace. And if we're wondering how do we accept it, the answer is we just come home. We just accept it. You go, well, then what do I do? Well, that's another thing to do. It's not a thing to do. It's a gift to receive. You died for us. You took the weight, the burden, the shame of our sin onto yourself so that you could restore us. You are the true and ultimate older brother who came to rescue us. And to that we say yes and thank you. Amen.